Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Hey, everybody. I need a quick favor from you guys. Before I get into my conversation with Liam, please go to iTunes and find Ivy Podcast and leave us a rating or a review. It really, really helps us a lot through from indexing perspective, from growth capabilities and other great stuff that comes along with that. So really appreciate a few minutes of your time. Just go to the iTunes and leave us a rating. Thanks so much. Now on to our recording with Liam.
Hey, I'm Liam Mulcahy, and I work for Unusual Ventures, which is an early stage venture capital
firm. Liam, thanks so much for making time to join us on the Ivy Podcast today. Very excited to finally connect with you. Before we talk a little bit about your current role, your responsibilities at Unusual, give us a thumbnail version of your career. What have you done prior to this, where you've been? Please share that.
Yeah, no, I'll try to make it a quick tour. So I was born and raised in New Jersey. I've got two younger sisters. We're all adopted from different families. I went to Rutgers, so I stayed local for college. I was a Division I runner there before becoming a full-time Division I college student. In terms of my career, I've always gravitated towards opportunities where I'm educating other people and kind of getting behind the mission, usually through a product lens. That brought me into a healthcare analytics startup. When I was first out of school, I went down to Dallas to work on that. Brought me to be a full-time CrossFit coach in New York City for a while. After that, I got into advertising at places like FCB and McCann. And that's kind of where I got bit by the tech bug. When I was at McCann, I was on a team solely dedicated to the Microsoft account for their global launch. So I got exposure to the Azure team and the cloud in general. And then that led me to go to MongoDB. I was there for 3 years, pre and post IPO. Pre-IPO, I was one of the number one sales reps in North America. And then post IPO, I ended up taking over the sales team I was on and turned that into the number one sales team worldwide at the time. And then the last 2 years and change, I've been at Unusual Ventures, first in San Francisco. Now I'm back on the East Coast. And Unusual Ventures is an early stage venture capital firm. I work specifically on a team internally called the GAP team. GAP just stands for Get Ahead Platform. And we will work with all the founders in the portfolio. I specifically focus on B2B and enterprise companies on help hit their early milestones, whether it's around product market fit, product market sales fit. But you can almost think of us as like a NASCAR pit crew team that gets deployed into the portfolio, helps them get the flywheel going across sales, product, marketing, community, education. And then we usually replace ourselves with their first full-time employees.
Well, that's super exciting. What a diverse career you've had so far. It sounds like you've done a little bit of everything, which is pretty exciting. And I'm sure you use a lot of that experience in what you're currently working on with helping startups get launched, growth, and all of that great stuff, which I want to spend time talking a little bit about it. In terms of you going through this trajectory of, you know, working in the capacity of also, you know, as a founder, as a operator yourself, and also working in, you know, in tech, building the sales team, and now being on the other spectrum of the equation, so to say, part of the venture fund, which my path is somewhat similar because I've founded and started multiple startups, failed most of them. Luckily, was able to have one exit, but through that experience, it's a continuous learning journey. And a lot of that is through trial and error. It's a lot of through experimentation as well. And now kind of shifting on to more on the angel investing side, for me, the main motivation is really to pass some of these learnings onto the startup founders and other operators. What was your decision-making as far as going to the venture side? What's the motivation there? How did you decide to take that path?
Great question. Actually, one that I get pretty frequently currently in sales roles at other startups. Hey, how'd you make the jump? Why'd you make the jump? Did it make sense to make the jump? If I zoom out for a second, when I look, my parents did, it's kind of come full circle. My mom was a teacher her whole life. My dad was in sales before becoming an entrepreneur. And now I help teach sales to entrepreneurs. entrepreneurs. So as hard as I tried to run away from that direction, I've kind of embodied my parents' careers. In terms of making the jump specifically of being a seller, a sales manager, and then going into venture, I've always liked to measure my impact. And a yardstick I'll measure my career success by is like, how many other people have I made successful? So when I met Jyoti and John, or the co-founders of Unusual, what was most appealing of the opportunity to me was I could not only scale the impact for one founder, I could do it for 40 founders or 50 founders, right? And that's 40 or 50 companies that I could help have a hand in shaping. It's the reason I got into management when I was at Mongo. Never wanted to be just like a super IC or a killer enterprise rep. I always wanted to manage a team and have more people be successful. So to me, that was the biggest opportunity. One was like, I can scale the amount of success I can bring to other people. And then two, you really have to become a company builder. If you're an IC at a company, it's extremely hard, but at the end of the day, you're selling one product into one vertical, usually to one user and one buyer. To me, I wanted to see if I had the ability to go ahead and sell multiple products to multiple buyers in different verticals. You know, and with what I do at Unusual, even in the last year, I've sold security tools, infrastructure, open source tools, but test metal as a salesperson. And I like that type of challenge. Sure.
All right, that's great. Well, that seems very interesting from a standpoint of kind of the career trajectory from the venture capital space, which a lot of times does come up in, you know, from our audience, people that, you know, the good portion of our audience are early stage career professionals. And, you know, one side of executives, the other side is you're at the cusp of either, you know, going the corporate route or starting something of your own, being an entrepreneur. So we get a lot of questions like that. And the path in venture capital is always of interest through, you know, through the conversations we're having. Where do you see yourself as you, progress through the, you know, through your career in venture capital? What's your shorter and longer term plans when it comes to kind of VC space?
It's a good question. The way that I think about the VC space, and this is just my opinion, is like there's two types of investors that I've met so far. One is what I'll describe as more of a classically trained investor. And that profile, I think your audience would be pretty familiar with. Some sort of an Ivy League school in their undergrad background, probably go to one of the big four consulting companies, maybe go back to an Ivy League school for business school, and then join a firm and either work their way up inside that firm or jump between multiple firms over time. And they're wildly successful. There's also the garage band investor, or at least that's what I like to call it. And those are usually operators that have turned into investors, right? So they were a subject matter expert. They joined a company that experienced some sort of hyper growth. And now they're taking that expertise and helping other companies with that knowledge in a venture firm. So kind of scaling and attributing what they learned to multiple people. I think the best firms are going to have a combination of both, because that's when you can really have the most value add to a lot of entrepreneurs. So for me, I love the ability to be able to double helix between operating at companies for a while and then stepping back and investing in companies for a while. Unusual is unique in the fact that I get to do both of those, so I can scratch both itches at this place. I'll be involved in helping source deals or doing diligence for deals or trying to win and get us into deals. And then the rest of my time and the majority of my time is spent working alongside the founders in our portfolio. So I get to kind of vacillate between both, of being an extension of a founder's team for 90 to 120 days or more, and then also helping the investment team win new people to become part of the Unusual family. So for me, I'd love to be able to keep this double helix motion going as long as I can, as long as I can earn that ability at Unusual. And that to me has been a pretty ideal career trajectory, or at least one that I'm starting off on the last 2 years.
Right. No, that's very exciting. And as you were entering, you know, venture capital, share with us anything that was, you know, somewhat of unexpected, or, you know, almost, I don't want to call that the dark side of the industry, but something that you did not know about, or something that was unusual, or part of Unusual Ventures. What did really stand out that you were like, oh, wow, I didn't really expect this as part of, you know, that comes with the territory or comes with the overall industry?
Yeah. And it's funny. It's hard to try to use the word unusual less now that I'm at Unusual. But to me, John, one of the biggest surprises is like when I joined a venture firm is that it's very different than being an operator. Mm-hmm. And this isn't a negative thing. It's just a different way that organizations function. So when you're at a company as an IC, it doesn't matter if you're on the engineering team or the go-to-market team. It's more like the NBA or any team where you have to pass a ball to achieve something. You're constantly working with other people to achieve a goal every day. Like, it's hard to do something alone inside of one of those companies. When you go to a venture firm, it's much more like the Ryder Cup, if you're familiar with that. Like, you know, a bunch of people playing an individual round of golf underneath the same flag. But at the end of the day, like, you're really only playing kind of for your score. Unusual does have like a very big team mentality, but I think most venture firms, like the biggest change for me was you have a partner meeting on Mondays and everybody gets together for a very deep in-depth, like 3-4 hour session. And then everybody kind of does their own thing during the week. So it's different in the terms of an operating cadence that I was typically used to, where I'm going in Monday through Friday, I'm working with the same, you know, 26 people every week for every month of the year. So that was a big change to me. And then I think one thing that surprised me was, I've heard other people on your show say this, so I don't want to be cliche, but like a lot of investors say that they're value add, but I was really surprised that, some of the larger firms or the stage agnostic firms, it can have a stock picking mentality to it, where they have so much capital to deploy and they have the positive brand affinity because they've been around for 15 or 40 years, that it can feel like they're just putting a chip on every square when they're working with entrepreneurs, where it's like, yeah, you know, we use our brand to get into the deal. We'll give you $4 or $5 million. And then mentality, unless you're part of that 10% of their portfolio that starts looking like it could be a fund returner. And then you probably can't get to go and be needing resources. So I'm really surprised that what we were doing at Unusual was so unusual. Like, the idea that you'd have people outside of a firm to work alongside the investment team in depth with the founders, extensions of their team, to help them with whatever their goals are set by the board for that quarter or that year. I was surprised that more firms were doing that at that level of depth.
Yeah, that's very interesting. And you couldn't have set me up any better for the next topic I want to cover with you, is the whole, you know, the entire concept of a value add investor, because there's a very interesting, you know, dynamic or relationship between the founders, operators, and the other side, the investors and, you know, the VCs and angels, so to say. And I've been on both sides. I am still on both sides. And it's interesting to hear both perspectives. For me, as an angel investor in, you know, startups, the number one objective is be a friend to a founder versus being a parent. And I see a lot where other investors or other firms operate more as from a parenting perspective, where it's, for me, where I, when I was a startup operator, it was a little bit of, you know, challenging. Yes, I was very open to learning a lot, but at the same time, it's almost also felt like I'm, you know, being guided too much by whoever, you know, the partners were at the time as an investors. So that's kind of some of the philosophy that I subscribe to is, and even the very initial evaluation criteria when I meet the founders for the first time, it's before we start talking about what you're building, am I able to get along with you so well? Because if I invest in your company, we're going to be attached at the hip at least the next 10 years together.
That's right.
If we can't have that very open conversation with each other, I think you know, it's not a good start. It's not a great recipe for success. So just that's kind of my two cents into that. But what's your overall take into kind of the value add investor, and how do you go about building those relationships with the founders?
In terms of the value add, I think the sea change you're starting to see in the venture space is, like, typically a value add at a venture firm for a long time was going to be somebody on the recruiting side, right? Hey, we've got a cohort of founders. We need somebody to help them, like, staff up their teams. So you'd see a lot of firms traditionally have had recruiters. Now, even in that experience, that's probably been like the same list of engineers or product people that's getting passed around to the entire portfolio. So it can be a bit of a feeding frenzy. And then aside from that, you've seen the rise of platform teams at venture capital firms. So typically what a platform team is going to do is either manage a network that a VC is plugged into. These could be people at the Fortune 500. They could be like C-suite networks where you're doing, you know, CIO dinners or trying to get feedback to portfolio companies, friendlies with the firm. When John and Jyoti looked at the market, like with John, you've got somebody who is a professional investor, was at Lightspeed as a partner for 12 years, has had a ton of success investing, was on the Midas list. And then you have Jyoti, who is like a pure builder and an engineer, right? Started at Dynamics, sold it for over $3 billion, started another company immediately in Harness, and also started Unusual. They kept seeing the same failure modes or hurdles that founders were running into. And it really fell across like five areas: sales, marketing, product, education, and community. So when we think about value add, we know that those are going to be the areas that founders typically, who are like 1% engineering talent, have not had a lot of exposure to. So we find that that's where we can be true like enablers and have the biggest needle moving impact for them, is helping them where they don't have experience, but it's going to be critical for the company's success. So I think that that's how we think about value add, is like, we actually do work with founders. So when I go into an engagement, I have the same success metrics that you'd put on an FTE, your first full-time head of sales, right? I may only be there for 2 quarters, and then I hire myself out of the job with whoever my replacement is as your first full-time hire. But in terms of founder fit for that, it does take a little bit of humility. Now, it's optional at Unusual. We think that teams can really benefit from working with the Gap team in that capacity, but you don't have to if you think you don't need to. But there does have to be a bit of humility where, if you look at the six functions, so throw engineering on the five that I mentioned, what are you exceptional at and where don't you need help? And what are you really struggling with and where do you need help? If a founder is like, I'm perfect, I don't need help anywhere, I just need capital and I need you to get out of the way, they're honestly probably not a fit. And that's okay. Like, you know, best of luck to them. But we think about ourselves almost like, you know, in college basketball, there's the rule now, you got to go 1 year of college before you go to the NBA. For us, like I think about Unusual as like a Duke or a Kentucky, right? We're an early stage firm. We're at the pre-seed, seed, and A level. If we can spend time with companies and help mold them to get them ready for the next 7 years, which is going to be the NBA, which could be any type of liquidation event down the road, it's just going to enhance their ability to achieve that goal, right? Some people can, like Kobe Bryant, you can go right from high school to the NBA. Some founders are exceptional at all six facets of that, and they literally just need capital. I'd argue that they're in the absolute minority in terms of like how many of them are out there that can do that. So our thought is like, we can be an Iron Man suit around you. You're still the founder. You're still making all the calls. To your point about the parenting mentality, like all I can do is show you what I found to be the most successful way to do things in my like area of expertise. We're never going to force a founder to do something. Like, this is their show, it's their company. It's a difference between us and like an incubator that may have like way more control and be a little bit more domineering. So I think that is the biggest difference. It's like, how do you measure the value you provide? If I was a founder, that's what I would ask a venture capital firm, right? Okay, you have all these services for me. How do you grade yourselves internally? Like, because for me, it's like, hey, if I work with these companies and they don't sell product and they're not hitting their revenue targets, then I'm going to be looking for a new job. You know, we've just made it that clear. It's a joint fail succeed model. And I think that's what you're going to see. You should see more of going forward.
Right. No, that, I like the analogy with from the basketball perspective, which makes sense and it resonates. And also, I've read a tweet somewhere, and I can't remember who exactly posted that, that it was somewhat of a similar analogy where, but on a completely different spectrum, that startup founders should be treated like the, you know, professional athletes, because at the end of the day, you're investing into a, you know, into a startup, into founders. It's also kind of professional athletes have all of their, you know, everything catered to them almost. Right. They got the chef, they got the professional treatment, all of that great stuff. And kind of the tweet was all about making that comparison, which I thought, you know, pretty interesting from a standpoint of also treating the founders as a professional athletes from that perspective. When you meet the founders for the very first time, or as you get to know them, for me, it's also important to kind of follow their digital breadcrumbs in a way, looking at their past history and getting to know them, some of the things that they had done historically, to really understand their mentality and just overall personality. Are you a creator? Are you a builder? or, you know, whatever the case may be. And it really, some of the things they've done in college as an example, and actually what Rachel and I, your colleague, we've talked about a little bit about that, whereas, you know, in college, for example, did you join a club or did you build a club? Also mm-hmm. that analogy of kind of the navigator versus the cartographer. Did you follow the map or did you actually create it? What are some of the things that really help you make sound decisions when it comes to founder evaluation at the very, very early stages when you get to know them?
On my side, I focus more on like founder market fit as it comes to like go to market. So like Rachel and the team are exceptional when it comes to like technology meeting a moment, meeting a market that's either existing or growing. I try to think about my function in that, in the organization, of like, how are we going to actualize the investment memo? And like, where does the founder have experience doing that, right? The investment memo to me is like the preview. And then we have to go in and like shoot the movie and actually make this thing happen. So the questions that I like to ask founders, to put it in a very simple way, is like, why? There's going to be a ton of decisions that they have to make. Some are going to be more reversible and less reversible around like their go-to-market strategy or their pricing strategy, or why is this group of customers the perfect niche for you to start with and dominate? Or, you know, if it's an open source company, how are you going to differentiate yourself from the project? And why are those features going to be the ones that people are going to want to pay for? Like, I just try to ask why around the current decisions that have been made. And that will usually give me a pretty good understanding about like how much thought and diligence have they done on the go-to-market side about like actually creating battle plans to have the surprise attack work. And then where can I also help, where they may have just had no experience or exposure thinking through these frameworks before. Right. So to me, I always try to start with why. And I think that's just a carryover from being in sales. It's, I think anybody that's good at doing discovery is going to do that. In terms of the background, I absolutely agree. I think any good salesperson is able to really sleuth on open source information about founders and get a picture for who this person is. So I think if I was to give like two other things that I look for, it's like, one is just speed, like is speed as a habit. There's going to be, time is your enemy as a startup. Like, time is your enemy in sales. Time is your enemy as a startup. You can't vacillate on decisions. You can't waffle and try to maybe do thing like two things half-assed. You need to like pick a course, be informed in your decision-making. You're never going to have perfect data, but you just need to have like a bias for action all the time. And I think you can pick that up in people's backgrounds. So usually the best founders were their first customers, like for their own problem. They were dealing with something at a company or like working with a product, and they were so pissed that there was not a better way to do something. They said, I'm just going to go make it. Right. So I think if you have that type of bias for action, you can see it in their history through college and anything else, but they're usually just very intelligent, coachable, driven people. And if you can get them to have some frameworks with decision-making around go-to-market, product decisions, hiring, then I think you've got a pretty good environment for them to thrive in the first 12 to 18 months of that company's life.
Right. No, those are great examples. And it kind of reminds me of somewhat of a framework that I also like to use when I talk to founders, is kind of from these categories perspective, whether the clarity of thought, I think it's a great indicator, whether can you clearly articulate not only the vision of something that you're trying to build, and you know, where you actually spend time in a bull case scenario. It's very easy to say why something will not work, but also, are you able to articulate if everything goes great, if everything goes really, really well according to plan and even better, where do you see your company in 10 years? Are you category defining? Are you just trying to make a dent into what particular problem you try to build? So I think that's very interesting. And then ability to learn and scale, something that you had mentioned, being very open to learning and having that open mind. I think, you know, very great founders really operate from that perspective, that you may not have that experience running a 100+ team. Because as a startup founder, majority, you're just starting out with a very small group of people. And as you scale, you go beyond the Series B, let's say, you're now at an enterprise level. And I think partnership with, for example, with like Unusual Ventures, I think would be of an utmost value, because at that point, you need all the help that you can get to really become that CEO who can run an enterprise level organization. And then last category is kind of that grit and determination, because as startup founders, we know, like, are you capable of living through hell through the next 4 or 5 years without nothing and just kind of be able to persevere from the, through that? So I think those are kind of very interesting dynamics from that standpoint. But you and I can probably talk about this on the rest of the episode. But just moving on from kind of the evaluation from the founder market fit and going into more kind of the PMF, the product market fit, when you look at the problems that these startups are trying to solve and whether they get that initial traction, a lot of feedback that I get from the founders that I meet is, well, I have this really, really great idea, and it's a problem that I've personally encountered, and I'm building this a prototype or a product that aims to solve that particular problem, but there's not a lot of traction. There's not a lot of, you know, indicators very early stage to show that this particular solution will fix that problem. How do you go about dealing with situations as such to be able to help founders formulate a clear plan that will provide them with an idea that there is an early indicator of the product market fit? What's your strategy there?
Yeah, it's I wish I could give a perfect answer, because then I think my career trajectory would be set if I could be a product market fit scientist to that exact right. degree. But I think about it in three phases, John. Like, if you're a founder, or if you're a potential founder, or if anybody's listening to this and you're thinking of starting a company, I think you always have to have a healthy level of skepticism that you're wrong. And then the best thing that you can do is go prove that you're right. So, like, find market proof to do that. The first thing I think you should go do is get value market fit. Would people find value in the thing you're thinking of building? And that doesn't take capital. Like, that is going out and having a hypothesis and, like, taking a scientific approach to your product idea and going to talk to 50 or 75 or 100 people that you think should want to use what you're going to build, and then take them through a theoretical if it existed, right? How would you install this? What would you benefit from? Are you actually experiencing the pain I'm trying to solve? If you could do what I'm saying you could do, what would that mean for you, your team, the business? How would you measure it? Would you put budget to it? Who would we take that budget from? You can almost live a product's life cycle through an interview before you've even written a line of code. If you just ask those thoughtful discovery questions, that's value market fit. So say you have those 50 conversations and you're starting to get signal from the noise around, you know what? There's a consistent theme here that people are struggling with this problem. It's causing this negative outcome. And if we can solve it this way, the business would be able to do this. You can quantify it. Then you want to, you know, say you get funding or angel investing, or you bootstrap yourself, you start to build. You need to find a subset of the people that you interviewed to actually install your beta version and try it in production, right? That's the first opportunity you're going to get for product market fit. Is your product able to be actualized, right? The value you said you would be able to have them derive if they use it in production. And this is, I'm not even talking about them paying you yet. It's literally just, is the product doing what you said it would do? Right. And we know you're going to have to debug it and it's going to be raw, but these people are looking for like a 10x increase in a business function. You should be able to. So most of them are to do that with you. Call them design partners at Unusual. They're like co-product builders. If you can actualize that value and then you can take the product away, or now they couldn't have like through their workflow or their without your product, that's like the first product market fit. Okay. It's doing what we said it would do, and really upset if they couldn't use it more, right? The market starting your product. And then the third, like when I think product market fit is plus, is people are consistently paying you for the value you're providing in a pretty predictable average price or ASP. Like you can refer to that as product market sales fit, but that's when I think it's nailed. Product market fit is always going to be a moving target. You don't hit it and then it's in the rearview mirror. As your product expands, your market expands, as your user expands, like you're always going to be trying to tighten that up. But if you are providing value consistently and your product is, you know, debugged as best it can be in the beginning, and people are paying you a consistent amount for consistent use cases, that to me sounds like product market fit. And I think thinking about it sequentially also makes it digestible for founders. Like you can start to get down the path even before you leave the company you're at by an interview process like I mentioned. So there's a ton of great content out there around like, how do you know if you have product market? I think the team from Superhumans got some great stuff. Andy Radcliffe, who was an advisor to and used some great stuff about product market fit. But for me, it's You know, do people, if you take the product away from them and in you not to take it away, will they pay you to keep it? Consistent amount.
Right. Right. Absolutely. No, I love this. I love these frameworks because, and like you said, there's no set formula specific for that. It's an ongoing effort because you can't just, you know, take this and say, oh, I got the product market fit and we're done. Let's just, you know, we are successful. It's a moving target indeed. And it's something to the extent that if you did find your early adopters, those early customers, and if you do a quick poll with them and say, like you were mentioning, if we were to take the you know, this product away from this pool of customers, which ones would be really, really upset? And those that respond with that particular, you know, with that passion, that they would be extremely upset that that product was taken away. Spend time there, really analyze what are some of the reasons why they would be so upset. That could be a goldmine of data that you could utilize to really also then use that to cater to other segments of the particular target audience that you're going after. So those are just some of the examples, and thank you for sharing that. What are some of the trends and ideas that you're really, really passionate about? Maybe that's outside of your day-to-day job or something that's, you know, in your free time at night when the kids are asleep, you're reading and researching all of that about. Share with us kind of from that perspective, what's on Liam's reading list is something that you're very passionate about.
Right. Recently, I've been very passionate about reading children's books and parenting books, but that's more personal in nature. To me, like most of my career has been in sales. So I've got a bias towards thinking about the go-to-market motion of companies. I think you see a really interesting thing happening now where you have big trends that have unlocked an incredible amount of value for engineering teams starting to jump the fence and happen on go-to-market. So what I mean by that is like customer observability, right? It's amazing how large scale public companies are still like having their salespeople basically function in a Mechanical Turk way to be their customer visibility. You're just throwing more humans at the problem to go figure out who wants to buy this and where they are. But you're seeing a lot of companies get started now where they're blending a lot of the data that you're getting from different parts of the business, product, marketing, sales, customer success, engineering, and giving you kind of a holistic view of what's going on. So I think getting sales teams smarter and more productive to me is a really interesting space. When you look at the most successful companies that were sales driven, it could be Mongo or Snowflake or Databricks or Datadog or whomever, the next crop of those companies, can they have the same amount of success with only 50 salespeople? And what would that world have to look like to do that? That's something that I think about all the time, right? How can we make people much more intelligent at selling? Because I don't think human sellers are going away, but I also don't think we're going to need as many as we have today. Like that's just my own personal take. And then I think another interesting thing on the go-to-market side too is like things like Dooley. We're not investors in that company, but if anybody looked into Dooley AI, it's basically an abstraction layer on top of Salesforce where it's kind of turning Salesforce into a database, right? Anybody who's worked with Salesforce, like it's a necessary evil. It's not exactly a friendly user experience. So there's a lot of companies that are being GUIs for go-to-market teams on top of tools that are allowing their data input for updating opportunities or anything else to be much smoother. So again, I think there's like really interest. It's almost like a command line, but for salespeople. So that's where a lot of my mind goes. As a firm in general, if I back up, like on the enterprise side, we focus a lot about like security, infrastructure, machine learning, dev tools, open source companies. I almost see open source more as a go-to-market path now, necessarily than a specific investment space. I know those businesses are unique, especially coming from Mongo, but you're seeing open source as like a motion become ubiquitous. There's open source security companies and dev tools and infrastructure companies and machine learning companies. So open source as a go-to-market motion and not a separate like category to me is also very interesting because it's a unique way to build a business when they can use your product for free and never pay you, right? It's like if you were selling cars and you could give somebody the keys for a test drive and like they didn't have to come back unless they wanted a sunroof. So there's a lot of unique aspects to working in that type of a business model. And that's something that, you know, in between reading Goodnight Moon that I'm thinking about a lot.
No, that's very interesting. It's Definitely, I can resonate with some of the trends and ideas that you're talking about, because especially coming out of pandemic and how the organizations structure their environments, whether you continue being fully virtual and, you know, whether, you know, you're creating the hybrid environment, and also the whole, the war for talent almost became the war on retention, because a lot of the companies right now, it's a big challenge. And even, you know, especially for startups where you don't necessarily have that brand or the name to be able to attract the top talent to your teams, let alone to retain them. I think it's a very interesting space that I've been researching a lot these days, as far as what are the different strategies that really work that help kind of these startups retain the top talent that they were able to secure very early stage when they were first starting out. So those are just some of the things that I've been researching a lot. And to take that a little bit further, what resources do you use for self-actualization or for from learning perspective? What are some of the things that, you know, you consume on a daily basis? Share with us the resources that really help you stay ahead of the game.
Yeah, in terms of like a content diet, I've always been a big podcast person. So I love like podcasts and YouTube. I try to listen to people that have already been very successful in certain domains. It's also just more convenient to do that in the background or if I'm walking around. So I'll listen to a lot of podcasts that are just like business specific in nature, VC specific, and then just, you know, more general things like I'll listen to like Equity, which I think is a great podcast about venture capital. I'll listen to like things like Marketplace or things like Science Friday when I don't want to think about tech. What the two things that I think are most important though, John, at least in development, is actually reading books that people reference. So I don't know if you feel this way, maybe you don't, but I've spent a lot of time since we were in lockdown. I'm looking at my books now, like reading the books that I think are first principle go-to-market books. And a lot of people will reference them. It could be Lean Startup. It could be Crossing the Chasm. Like, but I don't think a lot of people have actually read these books, because when you read them, there's so much gold in those hills that you introduce the concepts in casual conversations or in brainstorms. And then people are like, wow, that's a really novel way to think about that. And it's like, I got that from this book that like every business school on the planet uses. So I really think like when people recommend a book for you, read it, highlight it, take notes on it, try to read less books, but like actually use the knowledge in the books that you're reading. So I don't read for volume. I read like encyclopedically, and then I try to use the materials that are in those books. That's been a huge difference maker, because a lot of my frameworks are kind of a mishmash of a lot of things that I've read. And then second, I gave this advice to one of my cousins who just graduated college and they're starting off on their career. Like, have a framework for how you learn. There's so many tools out there nowadays, like Evernote or Notion or places where you can capture information. Like, have a framework for how you learn information. And it doesn't really matter what you start off doing it for. Like, it could be like your thoughts on art history or how to grow a great lawn or like the venture firms you want to be able to try to break into, but like systematize the way you learn, capture interesting information, and then try to take action on that. Because that I think is actually like one of the underpinnings of what makes a lot of people successful in any role at a tech company or a venture firm, is like being able to have to categorize your thinking efficiently. And like, How do you do follow-up? What does your task list look like? What's your to-do list look like? How do you make sure you don't drop the ball? Like, you get busy very quickly and you have a lot of information thrown at you. So how do you parse it out and make it like approachable when you need to go take action on it?
Right. Love that. And you've mentioned something around recommending books, and those that do recommend them to you, you definitely do take those recommendations seriously and you actually read them. What are some of your recommendations for maybe the books that you had read recently that made an impact? Share with us any recommendations there.
Yeah, I've got a lot. I'm going to keep the list short. One book that I think in general really helped me out is just called The Obstacle is the Way by Ryan Holiday. It's really just historical examples of how people have overcome adversity and like flipping your mindset to make challenges a good thing. If you want to get into a startup or you want to work at a venture firm, like you're going to need to have a pretty thick skin and the ability to look at challenges and setbacks like opportunities. That book's always helped me. If you're a founder and you really want to think about like go-to-market development, Crossing the Chasm by Jeffrey Moore is like a Bible for go-to-market development. And it's it's a book that's, you know, I think over two decades old at this point, but it still rings true today. Lean Startup and The Mom Test are two of the best books on the planet to go actually interview customers, which I mentioned before, on like your path to product market fit. If you're in sales and you really want to get like what I think is a pretty modern approach to go to market and sales specifically, read The Challenger Sale. That I think is probably going to be the most ubiquitous way to sell going forward. And read the sales, the Qualified Sales Leader by John McMahon. He is the godfather of enterprise selling. There's nobody better on the planet. And he finally wrote a book. So if you don't consume that, it's to your own detriment. And then the last one that I'll say, which is, again, you're zooming out a little bit, but How Will You Measure Your Life, I think is an incredible book. Like, it's always good to take stock of where you are and where you want to go and why. How'd you get to where you are and why are you trying to go to that certain destination? Those are the ones that I'm just looking at on my desk. But if anybody reaches out to me after the show, I'm like more than happy to provide a list of books that I have found useful, entertaining, or very informative.
Oh, that's super cool. Thanks for that recommendations. And for our listeners, we'll make those titles available in the show notes and definitely send some more. If you didn't get a chance to mention them, we'll include the whole list with that. That way we'll, and I'll definitely add some of those to my growing list of all the books that have been recommended and I'm trying to keep up with the pace. Liam, thanks so much for your time today. It was a very thought-provoking conversation. Personally learned quite a bit. Great insight, you know, the strategies, and you were very generous with some of the things that you do on a day-to-day basis. So definitely appreciate that. We'll stay in touch. We'll perhaps we'll do another episode in about a year or so and see how much have transpired.
Yeah, that'd be great, John. I appreciate it. It's been a fun conversation.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.